Side 9, The Boat of a Million Years, by Powell Anderson, continuing on page 253. Oh, Don, the money was nothing. The wish was the whole world and half the stars. She scrambled to her knees in the cockpit and pressed herself against him. He bent over, his left arm closed around her shoulders, his mouth sought hers. Flora, he said huskily, my beautiful, strange Flora. 5. We loved each other. I've never been afraid to love, Clara. You should learn how. The other woman stubbed out her cigarette and reached for a fresh one. What happened? Voice and visage grew blank. A revenue boat intercepted him in 1924. When he bade fair to outrun them, they opened fire. He was killed. Oh, I'm sorry. Laura shook herself. Well, we are familiars of death, you and I. Once more calm. He left me a quarter million in negotiable instruments. I needed to get away, sold my nightclubs, and spent the next 4 years traveling. First Ireland, England, France. In France I improved my French and studied about Africa. I went there, Liberia, then the colonies along that coast, hoping to discover something about my ancestors. I made friends in the bush and added to what I'd learned from books more of how those tribes live, what they live by, faith, ritual, secret societies, tradition. That caused me to return by way of Haiti, where I also spent a while. Clara's eyes widened. Voodoo? Vodun, Loras corrected. Not black magic, religion. What has sustained human beings through some of the cruelest history on earth, and still does in some of its most hideous poverty and misrule. I remembered people here at home, and came back to Harlem. I see, Clara breathed. You did start a cult. Momentarily, Laras was grim. And you're thinking, what a nice racket. It isn't like that in the least. Oh, no, I didn't mean you did. Laras sighed. Never mind, a natural thought. I don't blame you. But the fact is, I had no need to prey on superstition. Investments I'd made before going abroad had done well. I didn't like the look of the stock market and pulled out in time. Oh, by myself, I'd be quite comfortably off. Seriously. There were my people, though. There was also the matter of my own long-range survival, and now yours. Clara showed near bewilderment. What have you done, then, if you haven't founded a church? Ross spoke quickly, impersonally. Churches and their leaders are too conspicuous, especially if they achieve some success. Likewise, revolutionary movements. Not that I wish for a revolution. I know how little bloodshed ever buys. That must be still more true of you. I never gave it your kind of thought, Clara said humbly. Her cigarette smoldered unnoticed between her fingers. What I am organizing is, call it a society, somewhat on the African and Haitian model. Remember, those outfits aren't criminal, nor are they for pleasure. They are parts of the whole, the cultures, bone and muscle as well as spirit. Mine does contain elements of both religion and magic. In Canada, I was exposed to Catholicism, which is one root of Vodun. I don't tell anybody what church he should go to, but I open for him a vision of being not only a Christian, but belonging to the whole living universe. I don't lay curses or give blessings, but I say words and lead rites in which I am not a goddess or messiah, not even a saint, but she who is closer than most to understanding, to power. Oh, we have a practical aspect, too. A Haitian would know what I mean by this surname I've taken, but I don't call for gaining control, not by vote like the Republicans and Democrats, or by violence like the Communists, or by persuasion like the socialists. No, my politics is individuals quietly getting together under leadership they have freely accepted, helping each other, building a life and a future for themselves. Clara shook her head. I'm sorry, I can't quite see what you mean. Don't worry. Warmth was in the reply. For the time being, think of it on the spiritual side as offering my followers something better than booze and coke. As for the material part, now that bread lines have gotten long, more and more hear about us and come to us, black, white, Puerto Rican, every race. Openly, we're just another among hundreds of volunteer groups doing poor relief. Quietly, as newcomers prove trustworthy and advance through our degrees of initiation, we take them into a community they can belong to, work in, believe in, modestly but adequately, and with hope. In return, when I ask for it, they help me. Noras paused before continuing. I can't explain it much better than that today. You learn. Truth to tell, I'm learning, too. I never laid out any grand scheme. I fumbled my way forward, and still do. Maybe this will crash to ruin or decay. But maybe. I can't foresee. Immortal leadership ought to make an important difference, but how to use it, I'm not yet sure. About all that I feel reasonably sure of is that we have to keep ourselves from being noticeable. Can you? We can try. We includes you, I trust. Ross lifted her wine glass. Here's to tomorrow. Clara joined in the toast, but remained troubled. What are your plans for the near future? Considerable, Ross answered. And you can do a great deal. You save your money, right? Well, we, the society, we're stretched thin. We badly need operating capital. Opportunities go begging. For instance, since the crash, stocks are at rock-bottom prices. Because we've got a depression, I thought you said you left the market. Ross laughed. If I'd foreseen exactly what would happen 2 years ago October, I'd have sold short at the right point and now own Wall Street. But I am not a sorceress, nor do I claim to be, and I've learned to play cautious. That doesn't mean timid or unthinking. Look, depressions don't last forever. People will always want homes, cars, 1,000 different good, solid things, and sooner or later they'll again be able to buy them. It may take 50 years to collect our profit, but immortals can wait. I see. Clara's features came aglow. Okay, with that to look forward to, I can stand another 50 years in the life. You needn't. Times are changing. What men want won't change. No, though the laws may. No matter. Clara, shake free of that sordidness as fast as you can unload. What for? What else can I do? I don't know anything except... With forlorn determination. I will not turn into a parasite on you. I won't. Oh, no, Loras answered. We take no parasites in. Quite aside from the money you contribute, you will earn your keep. You may not appreciate it yet, but you have 1,400 years of experience behind you, with the insight, the intuition that must have brought. Yours may well be a better wisdom, but we need it. What for? For the building of our strength, huh? Wait, you said... I said I do not intend to overthrow the government, take over the country, anything stupid or ephemeral like that, Loras declared. My aim is the exact opposite. I want to build something so strong that with it we can say no to the slavers, the lynch mobs, and the lords of state. Men seized my father, bore him away in chains, and sold him. They hounded me when I escaped, and would have caught me if other men had not broken their law. A few years ago they shot down the man I loved, for nothing worse than providing a pleasure they said nobody must have. At that he was lucky. He might have died earlier in their damned useless war. I could go on, but why? You could tell more as much longer as you've lived. What's brought this death and misery but that men have had power over other men? Don't mistake me. I am not an anarchist. Human beings are so made that the few will always rule the many. Sometimes they mean well. In spite of everything, I believe the founders of the United States did. But that doesn't long outlive them. The only partial security we who want to lead our own lives will ever have we must create from within us. Oneness, ongoing resolution, the means to live independent of the overlords. Only by guiding the poor and helpless toward this can we immortals win it for ourselves. Are you with me? Chapter 16. Niche. The hotel was new and rather soulless, but it stood near Old Town, with a fine tenth-floor view of roofs and narrow streets climbing to the stones of the citadel. That mass stood darkling athwart stars dimmed by lamps and lightful panes. On the west side, the corner suite overlooked modern Ankara, Ulu Square, the boulevard, radiance glaring and flashing, opulent storefronts, crowded sidewalks, hasty automobiles. Heat of a day in late summer lingered, and the windows stood open to catch whatever coolness crept in off the river and hinterland. Height muffled traffic noise, even car horns, to an undertone hardly more loud than the large fan whirring on its stand. For the American patron and his dinner guest, room service had set an elegant table and carried up an excellent meal. Through most of it they had sparred with small talk. The language in which they could most readily converse turned out to be Greek. Now they were at the stage of cheese, coffee, and liqueurs. Akte Segun leaned back, held his dram buoy to the light before he sipped, creased his jowls with a smile. He was a stocky, paunchy man, his nose the single impressive thing about him. While not shabby, his business suit had clearly been years in use, and inexpensive when bought. "Ah," he murmured, "delicious. You are a most knowledgeable gentleman, Kyrie MacReady." "I am glad you enjoyed this," replied the other. "I hope you feel more at ease with me." Segun cocked his head in bird-like fashion, if the bird be a well-fed owl or parrot. David MacReady was 2 or 3 centimeters taller than he, lean and limber, though the dark hawk visage showed only geniality. The eyes, oddly levantine for the name he bore, met his own and searched. "Did I give you the opposite impression?" Segun asked. "I'm sorry. What a poor return for your hospitality. Not my intention at all, I assure you." "Oh, I don't blame you. A telephone call, an invitation from a perfect stranger. I might want to lure you into some criminal scheme, or I might be a foreign agent, a spy. These days they must swarm in every capital." Segun chuckled. "Who would bother to subvert a little bureaucrat in the purely civilian archives? If anything, you would be the endangered one. Think, you have had your dealings with our bureaucracy. It is impossible not to, especially if one is a foreigner. Believe me, when we set our minds to it, we can tangle, obstruct, and bring to a dead halt a herd of stampeding elephants. Still, this is an uneasy time." Segun turned grave. His look wandered out the window, nightward. "Indeed," he said low, "an evil time. Herr Hitler was not content with engulfing Austria, was he? I fear Mr. Chamberlain and Monsieur Daladier will let him work his will on Czechoslovakia, too. And nearer home, the ambitions of the Tsars live on in Red Russia." He turned his attention back, took forth a handkerchief, wiped his narrow brow, and sleeked down his black hair. "Pardon me. You Americans prefer optimism always, not so? Well, whatever happens, civilization will survive. It has thus far, no matter what changing guises it wears." "You are quite well informed, Kyrie Segun," MacReady said slowly. "And something of a philosopher, it seems." The Turk shrugged. "One reads the newspapers. One listens to the radio. The coffee shops have become a babble of politics. I seek occasional relief in old books. They help me tell the transient from the enduring." He drained his glass. MacReady refilled it and asked, "Cigar?" "Why, yes, thank you very much. That humidor of yours appears to hold promise." MacReady fetched 2 Havanas, a clipper which he offered first to his guest, and a lighter. As he settled himself again, his voice shivered the least bit. "May I get to my business now?" "Certainly. You would have been welcome to do so earlier. I assumed you wished to become acquainted, or, if I may put it thus, to feel me out. MacReady's grin was wry. You did the better job of that on me. Oh, I simply enjoyed a pleasant conversation with an interesting person. Everybody is fascinated by your wonderful country, and your career as a businessman has been remarkable. MacReady started his visitor's cigar for him, and became occupied with his own. We went on at length about me, when talk didn't ramble over ordinary matters. The upshot was that scarcely anything got said about you. There was nothing to say, really. I am as dull and insignificant a man as you will ever find. I cannot imagine you maintaining any interest in me. Segun drank smoke, rolled it around his tongue, exhaled luxuriously, chased it with a taste of liqueur. However, at the moment I am glad. Pleasures like this seldom come to a minor official in a routine-bounded department of government. Turkey is a poor country, and President Ataturk was rather ruthless about corruption. MacReady's tobacco kindled less smoothly. My friend, you are anything but dull. You've proved yourself very shrewd, very skillful at hiding whatever you want to hide. Well, it's no great surprise. People in our situation who don't have those qualities, or can't acquire them, probably don't last long. Beady eyes widened. Our situation? What might that be? Still cautious, are you? Understandable. If you are what I hope, that's an old, old habit. If not, then you are wondering whether I am a confidence man or a madman. No, no, please. Your newspaper advertisement last year attracted me. Enigmatic, but somehow genuine. Indeed, wonderfully phrased. Thank you, though composing it was largely the work of my partner. He has a gift for words. I take it you place the advertisement in many places around the world? MacReady nodded, and Segun continued. I suppose not only the language, but the text, the message, varied according to region. Here, how did it go? Those who have lived so long that our forefathers are like brothers and comrades to them. Yes, that appeals to a Near Easterner, a citizen of an ancient land. Yet the average person who chances to see it gets the impression that a scholar is interested in meeting old people who have studied and meditated upon history, with a view to exploring whatever wisdom may be theirs. Did many respond? No. Most who did were not quite right in the head or tried to cadge money. You were the only one in this country whom my agent decided I might care to follow up. It has taken you a considerable time. I had begun to think your organization was not serious, perhaps a hoax. I had to study a number of reports. Most I discarded. Then I started off around the world. This is my third interview. I gather an agent of yours met those who answered the advertisements everywhere that they were placed. Clearly you have substantial resources, Kyrie MacReady, for a purpose you have yet to reveal to me, and, I dare say, have told none of the agents. The American nodded. I gave them certain secret criteria to apply. Peering through the smoke, the most important was that a respondent look young and in good health, even though the call seemingly was for old people. I explained that I don't want the fact publicized, but I am searching for natural-born geniuses, with knowledge and insight far beyond their years, especially in history. With minds like that from different civilizations brought into contact, we may found a real science of it, beyond anything that thinkers like Spengler and Toynbee have proposed. The agents doubtless consider me a crackpot on this subject. However, I pay well. I see. Have the previous two whom you met proven satisfactory? You know that isn't what I am really searching for, MacReady said. Segun laughed. In the present case, that is just as well. I am no genius of any kind. No, a total mediocrity, and content with it, which shows I am doubly dull. He paused. But what about those other two? MacReady chopped air with his cigar. Damnation, he exclaimed. Must we shilly-shally all night? Segun leaned back in his chair. The broad face and small, bland smile could be a visor over weariness, glee, anything. "God forbid I repay your generosity with discourtesy," he said. "Perhaps it would be best if you took the lead and made a forthright statement." "I will." MacReady sat half-crouched. "If I'm wrong about you, you won't take me for merely eccentric. You'll believe I'm a raving lunatic. In that case, I suggest you go home and never speak of this evening to anybody, because I'll deny everything, and you'll be the one to look silly." In haste, "That's not a threat. For the convenience of us both, I request your silence." Séguin elevated his glass. "From your viewpoint, you are about to take a risk," he replied. "I understand. I promise." He drank as if in pledge. MacReady stood up. "What would you say," he asked softly, "if I told you I am not an American by birth, that I was born in these parts nearly 3,000 years ago? Séguin gazed into his drink a while. The city mumbled. A drape stirred ever so slightly to the first night breath off the plateau of Anatolia. When he raised his eyes, he had gone expressionless. "I would call that a most unusual statement." "No miracles, no magic," MacReady said. "Somehow it happens. Once in 10 million births, 100 million, 1 billion. The loneliness." "Yes, I am a Phoenician from Tyre, when Tyre was new." He began pacing to and fro on the carpet. "I've spent most of all that time seeking for others, any others like me." "Have you found them?" MacReady's tone harshened. "3, certain. And of them, a single one is still alive, to my knowledge, my partner whom I mentioned. He's tracked down 2 possibilities himself. As for the other 2, we don't age, you know, but we can be killed the same as anybody else." Savagely, he ground his cigar out in an ashtray. "Like that." "Then I suppose the 2 you have spoken with on this journey, they were disappointments?" MacReady nodded. He slammed fist into palm. "They're what I am officially after, highly intelligent and thoughtful, young people. Maybe I can find a place for them. I do have my enterprises, but—" He stopped on the floor, legs wide apart, and stared. "You're taking this very calmly, aren't you?" "I admitted I am a dull person, phlegmatic, which gives me reason to think you're different from them, and my agent did make a quiet investigation. You could pass for a man in his 20s, but you've held your present job more than 30 years. My friends remark on it, not with much envy. I am no Adonis. Well, some individuals are slow to grow wrinkled and gray. Friends, you're neither sociable nor unsociable, affable but never intimate, effective enough at your desk, promoted according to seniority, but unambitious. You do everything by the book. Unmarried. That's uncommon in Turkey, but not unheard of, and nobody is interested enough in you to wonder seriously. Your judgment is less than flattering." Séguin didn't sound offended. "Reasonably accurate, though. I have told you I am content to be what I am. An immortal?" MacReady flung at him. Séguin lifted a palm, cigar between fingers. "My dear sir, you leap to conclusions." "It fits, it fits. Listen, you can be honest with me, or at least bear with me. I can show you evidence that's convinced men more intelligent than either of us, if you'll cooperate. And how can you just sit there like that?" Séguin shrugged. "If nothing else, even if I'm wrong about you, and you suppose I'm crazy, you ought to show some excitement," MacReady snapped. "A desire to escape, if nothing else. Or that I think you are ageless yourself, you can join us, and together we can—" "How old are you, anyway?" Into the stillness that followed, Séguin said, a new steel in his tone, "Credit me with some brains, if you please. I have told you I read books, and I have had a year to consider what might lie behind that curious evasive procedure of yours, and conceivably before then I have speculated about these matters. Would you mind taking your seat again?" I prefer to talk in civilized wise. My apologies. First, MacReady went to the sideboard. He mixed a stiff scotch and soda.
Would you like this?
No, thank you. Another drambuie, if I may. Do you know, it never came to my attention before tonight. But then, only recently has Turkey become a modern, secular state. Marvelous stuff. I must lay some in before the next war makes it unattainable. MacReady overcame interior tumult and returned to the table.
What do you want to say? He asked.
Segun barely smiled.
Well, he replied, things were growing hectic, weren't they?
To be expected, no doubt, when you made such extraordinary claims. Not that I deny them, Kyrie. I am no scientist to decide what is and is not possible, nor am I so rude as to call my host deluded, let alone a liar. But we should calm down. May I tell you a story?
By all means, MacReady rasped, and drank deep.
Perhaps I can better label it a speculation, Segun said. A flight of fancy, like some works of Mr. H.G. Wells. What if such and such were true? What consequences?
Go on.
Segun relaxed, smoked, sipped, let his voice amble. Well, now, shall we imagine a man born rather long ago? For example, in Italy toward the end of the Roman Republic? Family of the equestrian class, undistinguished, its men seldom much interested in war or politics, seldom succeeding or failing greatly in commerce, often making careers in the civil service. The state and its conquered provinces had grown swiftly, enormously. There was need for clerks, registrars, analysts, archivists, every class of those workers who provide a government with its memory. Once Augustus had taken control, procedures were soon regularized, organization made firm, order and predictability instilled. For a peaceful man, the lower and median ranks of the civil service were a good place to be. MacReady inhaled sharply. Segun ignored it. Next, I would like to borrow your imaginative concept of the occasional person who never grows old. Since you have obviously considered every ramification, I need not spell out the difficulties that the years must bring to such a man. Perforce, when he reaches the normal retirement age, he gives up his position and moves away, telling his acquaintances that it will be to some place with a mild climate and a low cost of living. Yet if he is entitled to a pension, he dares not draw it forever. And if pensions are not customary, he cannot live forever on savings or even on investments. He must go back to work. Well, he seems youthful, and he has experience. He re-enters the bureaucracy in a different city, under a different name, but quickly proves his worth and earns promotion from junior grade to about the middle of the hierarchy among the record keepers. In due course, he retires again. By then, sufficient time has gone by that he can return to, say, Rome, and start over. Thus it goes. I shan't bore you with details when you can readily visualize them. For example, sometimes he marries and raises a family, which is pleasant, or if it happens not to be, will pass. So all he needs is patience. This does complicate his little deceptions, hence he spends other periods in tranquil bachelorhood, varied by discreet indulgences. He is never in any danger of being found out. His position in the archives enables him to make cautious but adequate insertions, deletions, emendations. Nothing to harm the state, nothing to enrich himself, no, never. He simply avoids military service and, in general, covers his tracks. Segun snickered. Oh, now and then he might slip in something like a letter of recommendation for the young recruit he plans to become. Please remember, though, that he does do honest work. Whether he puts stylus to wax, pen to paper, nowadays types or dictates, he helps maintain the memory of the state.
I see, MacReady whispered. But states come and go.
Civilization continues, responded Segun. The Principate hardens into the Empire, and the Empire begins to crack like drying mud. But people go on getting born and getting married. They ply their trades and die.
Always they pay taxes, and whoever rules must hold the records of this, or he has no power over the life of the people. The usurper or the conqueror may strike off heads at the top, but he will scarcely touch the harmless drudges of the civil service. That would be like chopping off his own feet.
It has happened, MacCready said bleakly. Segun nodded.
True, corruption rewards its favorites with jobs. However, certain jobs are not especially tempting, while at the same time their holders would be hard to dispense with. Then occasionally barbarians, fanatics, megalomaniacs attempt to make a clean sweep. They cause desolation. Nevertheless, more often than not, some continuity endures. Rome fell, but the church preserved what it could. I suppose, though, MacCready said, word by word, this man you are imagining had moved to Constantinople.
Segun nodded. Of course, with Constantine the Great himself, who necessarily expanded the government offices in his new capital and welcomed personnel willing to transfer. And the Roman Empire, in its Byzantine incarnation, lasted another 1,000 years. After which, oh, there were difficult times, but one manages. Actually, my man was stationed in Anatolia when the Osmanlis overran it, and did not get back to Constantinople until they had taken it too, and renamed it Istanbul. Meanwhile, he had fitted into their order of things without many problems, changed his religion, but surely you can sympathize with that, and with a certain recurring necessity that an immortal Muslim or Jew faces.
Segun half-grinned. One wonders about possible women. Recurrent intactness. His mien went back to mock professorial. Physically, this man would stay inconspicuous. The original Turks were not very unlike the people here, and soon melted into them the same as Hittites, Gauls, Greeks, Romans, countless nations had done before. The sultans reigned until after the World War, in name at any rate, frequently not in fact. It made small difference to my man. He simply helped maintain the records. Likewise under the Republic. I must confess my man, prefers Istanbul, and looks forward to his next period of working there. It is more interesting and alive with ghosts, but you know that. However, by now Ankara has become quite livable.
Is that all he wants? MacCready wondered, shuffling papers in an office. Forever?
He is used to it, Segun explained. Perhaps it actually has a trifle more social value than soaring hopes and high adventure. Naturally, I wanted to hear what you had to say, but, forgive me, the situation you describe is ill-suited to one of my temperament. Let me wish you every good fortune.
May I have your card? Here is mine.
He reached in his pocket. MacCready did likewise. They exchanged.
Thank you. We can, if you so desire, mail new cards to each other as occasion arises. The time may possibly come when we have reason to communicate. Meanwhile, absolute confidentiality on both sides. Agreed?
Well, but listen, please. I detest disputes.
Segun glanced at his watch. My, my! Time flies, eh? I really must go. Thank you for an evening I will never forget.
He rose. MacCready did, too, and helplessly shook hands. Having bade good night, the bureaucrat, still relishing his cigar, departed. MacCready stood in the hall door till the elevator bore him off, down into the city, and its crowds of the anonymous.
Chapter 17 Steel. This was not the forest of old, but there was cover aplenty for a hunter, oh yes, and all too much quarry. First, though, Katya had open ground to cross. She went from the battered yellow brick of the Lazur chemical plant on her belly. The pavement beneath her was as rough after nearly 3 months of war. It felt colder against her palms than did the wind on her face. Clouds and a little snow had slightly warmed the November air. She slipped forward a meter or so at a time, stopped, peered about, before the next advance. Heaven rested heavy, hiding the sun behind its gray.
Sometimes it let fall a thin white flurry for the gusts to scatter. On Katya's left, the ground sloped to the Volga. Ice floes drifted, bumped together, churned and turned on their way down its steel-hued stream. No boats dared move among them. Scant help could come to the Russians from the east until the river froze hard. The shore opposite seemed deserted, steppe reaching, wan with winter, on and on into Asia. To her right, beyond the railroad tracks, Mamayev Hill rose 100 meters aloft. Its slopes were black. Shells and boots quickly beat snow into mud. She identified 2 or 3 gun emplacements. Silence brooded. The soldiers who had contested that height for weeks must be catching their breath or a few moments' sleep, briefly brothers in exhaustion and wretchedness, before the next combat erupted. The stillness foreboded. It was abnormal to hear no fire anywhere for this long a stretch. War waited, eyes and gun sights wholly upon her. Nonsense, she snapped to herself and moved onward. Nevertheless, when she came in among walls, breath shuddered from a breast cage that had begun to ache. She rose and stood crouched. These were not truly walls after what had happened to them. Concrete blocks still lifted sheer, but doorless doorways and glassless windows yawned on emptiness. A heap of rubble had spilled into the street. Rifles cracked. A submachine gun chattered. A grenade popped. Another, another. Shouts ripped raw. She couldn't make out words. The sounds were inhuman. Her own rifle was off her shoulder, and she inside the shell of a building as the first echoes died. Boots thudded. They hit without rhythm, and too often a shard rattled from them. Whoever drew near stumbled and staggered more than he ran. Katya risked a peek around the door jamb. From behind a ruin some 20 meters south, a man lurched into the intersection of this street and the one down which he fled. He wore a red army uniform and helmet, but carried no weapon. Blood smeared his right hand and dripped down that leg. He stopped. She saw how he panted. He swung his head to and fro. Almost she called to him, but checked herself. After a few seconds he continued his weaving way in the same direction, out of her view. She brought her rifle up. 2 more men appeared, at a lope that should soon overtake him. Squarish helmets and gray-green garb proclaimed them Germans. Either could easily have lifted his own firearm and shot the fugitive, so their officer must have told them to bring him back for interrogation. That looked safe, a short run through an area believed to be free of life. It had stabbed through Katya. Let the thing happen. I mustn't compromise my mission. But she knew too well what awaited that fellow. Also, what he could tell might prove as valuable as anything she would observe. Decision was nearly instant. Sometimes she weighed a matter for years before she settled on what to do. Sometimes she could simply wait several decades and let time wear the problem away. Yet she had not stayed alive this long by being always hesitant. At need, she leaped with the unheeding energy of youth. She fired. A German spun on his heel and flopped bonelessly down. His companion yelled and threw himself prone. His rifle barked. He probably hadn't seen her, but knew at once, more or less, whence that shot had come. Quick-witted. Not for the first time, the thought stirred in Katya that maybe among the invaders was one of her kind, as full of centuries and solitude as she was. She barely noticed the thought, afar at the back of her skull. She had pulled inside straightway after shooting. A window frame beckoned. She closed her eyes for 3 breaths while she considered the geometry of what she had seen. The enemy must be there. Quick, before he moves elsewhere. She stepped to the hole and squeezed trigger even as she aimed. The butt gave her a stiff, friendly nudge. The soldier screamed. He let go his rifle and lifted his torso on hands that spread, white, helpless, upon asphalt. She had gotten him in the back. Best silence him. Those yells would call his mates. She drew a bead. His face exploded. Extraordinary marksmanship. By far the most shots in battle went wild. Comrade Zaitsev would be proud of her. She wished the German would lie still like the first, not writhe and kick and gush blood. Well, he was quiet now. She hadn't time to cringe. Surely the rest understood something had gone wrong. No matter how cautious, they would find this place within minutes. Katya dashed forth over the rubble, up the street, past her prey. Horrible when it was human. Of course, then it hunted you likewise. She turned left down the cross street. The Soviet soldier had not gone far. Her ambush had been quick while he slowed still more. In fact, he was shuffling by a wrecked tram, leaning on it. Katya wondered if he would prove such a burden that she must abandon him. She sped in pursuit. "Stop!" she cried. "I'm your help." Her voice sounded small and hollow among the ruins beneath the leaden sky. He obeyed, turned around, braced himself against the metal, slumped. She drew close and halted. He was quite young, she saw, not shaven lately, but with just a dark fuzz over the skin. Otherwise his face was old, pinched, white as the snowflakes that drifted about and powdered his shoulders. His eyes stared, and his jaw hung slack. Shock, she realized. That hand of his was pretty badly mangled. A grenade, no doubt. "Can you follow me?" she asked. "We'll have to move fast." His left forefinger rose and wobbled in the air as if to trace her outline. "You are a soldier," he mumbled. "Like me. But you are a woman." "What of it?" Katya snapped. She took hold of his forearm and shook him. "Listen, I can't stay. That's death. Come along if you're able. Do you understand? Do you want to live? Come!" He shuddered. Breath went raggedly down his throat. "I can try." "Good. This way." Katya shoved him around and forward. "Turn right at the next corner, left at the next after that. Put a maze between yourself and the enemy." This district was smashed like the city center toward which she aimed. Snags, debris, choked lanes, masonry still fire-blackened in spots. A wilderness where you could shake your hunters. Despite lacking sun or shadows, she kept her sense of direction. A growl resounded. "Take cover," Katya ordered. The youth joined her beneath a rusted metal sheet which stuck out of a vast heap of wreckage like an awning. A stench hung beneath, oozing from bricks, beams, broken glass, thick and sickly sweet even in the chill. A shell or bomb must have made a direct hit, bringing this whole tenement down on everybody inside. Children, their mothers, their babushkas. No, most who couldn't fight were evacuated early on. Likeliest it was soldiers who rotted here. Any building could become a fort when defenders fought invaders street by street. Which had these been? It didn't matter. Least of all to them. Her companion retched. He must have recognized the smell. That was a hopeful sign. He was coming out of his daze. The aircraft swept low above rooflessness. She had a glimpse of it, lean, swift, swastika on its tail. Then it was gone. Reconnaissance of what? Probably the pilot wouldn't have noticed them or troubled about them if he did. But you could never tell. The fascists had strafed crowds of evacuees waiting for ferries across the river. Two Soviet soldiers were game warfare. The throbbing receded. Katya heard no other. "Let's go," she said. The young man accompanied her for some paces before he exclaimed weakly, "Is this right, comrade? I think we're headed south." "We are," she told him. But the enemy has that part. Our people, they're in the north end of town." "I know." She took his elbow and hurried him onward. "I have my orders. Turn back if you wish. I doubt you'll get far, or you may come with me if you can. If you can't, I'll have to leave you. If you make a noise or any kind of trouble for me, I must kill you. But I do believe it's your only chance." He clenched his usable fist. "I'll try," he whispered. "Thank you, comrade." She wondered whether Zaitsev would thank her. This mission was worth more lives than a single cripple's. Well, sharpshooters must rely on their own judgment oftener than not. And supposing she did get this private back to his unit, her superiors needn't know, unless he really could tell something worthwhile. The street ended at Krutoy Gully. On the opposite side of the ravine, buildings were equally damaged, but more high and massive than here. That was where the central city began. "We have to get across," Katya said. "No bridge. We crawl down and creep up. You go first." He nodded jerkily, nevertheless a nod. stooping, he scuttled over the open space and wriggled out of sight. She had been prepared to let him draw any fire. She hadn't wanted a stalking horse, but there he was, and if he proved hopelessly clumsy, she couldn't let him destroy her, too. Instead, he did well enough. So he'd been rather lightly shocked, and was shaking that off with the vitality of youth. Rifle in hand, every sense honed, she followed. Dirt gritted, leafless bushes scratched. After they started up, his strength flagged. He scrabbled, slid back away, sank together, and sobbed for air. She slung her weapon and went on all fours to his side. He gave her a desperate look. "I can't," he wheezed. "I'm sorry. Go on." "We're nearly there." Her left hand clasped his. "Now work, damn you, work!" She clambered backward, boot heels dug into soil, straining like a horse at a mired field gun. He set his teeth and did what he was able. It sufficed. They reached the top and found shelter by a heap of bricks. Her tunic was dank with sweat. Wind chilled her to the bone. "Where are we bound?" coughed from him. "This way." They got to their feet. She herded him along, keeping them next to walls, halting at each doorway or corner to listen and peer. A couple of fighters flew sentinel well above. Their drone fell insect faint over the desolation. She began to hear a deeper rumble. Artillery. A duel somewhere out on the steppe. Mamaev remained quiet. The whole city did, it seemed. One great graveyard that waited for the thunders of doomsday. Her destination wasn't far. That would have been madness. She would not have been sent even this deep into the German-held sector had she not repeatedly shown she could get about unseen as well as any commando. And she knew those expert killers were less expendable than she. If the recommended site proved unduly dangerous and she couldn't quickly find a better, she was to give up and make her way back to the Lazur. From behind one of the trees that still lined a certain boulevard, she gazed across a bomb crater and two crumpled automobiles. The building she wanted did appear safe. It belonged to a row of tenement houses, slab-sided and barrack-like. Though in sorry shape, it rose above what was left of its neighbors, a full 6 floors. The windows were blind holes. Katja pointed. "Yonder," she told the young man. "When I signal, get over there and inside, fast." She took her binoculars from the case hung about her neck and searched for signs of enemy. Only broken panes, smudges, pockmarks came into view. Snow whirled dry on a gust that whistled. She chopped her hand downward and led the sprint. In the empty doorway, she whirled about and crouched ready to fire at anything suspicious. The snow flurry had stopped. A scrap of paper tumbled along before the wind. Flights of concrete stairs went steeply upward. Their wells were full of gloom. On the lower landings, doors blown off hinges lay in a chaos of things and dust. Above, they remained shut. On the top floor, she tried a knob. If necessary, she would shoot out the lock, but that door creaked faintly as it yielded. Here, the dimness was less. Smashed windows admitted light as well as cold. The apartment had been fairly good, 2 rooms plus a kitchen alcove. To be sure, the bathroom was a flight down, shared by the tenants of 3 floors. Concussion had cracked plaster off lath and spread chunks and powder across furniture and threadbare carpet. Rain blowing in had made a slurry, now hardened, under the sills. Mildew speckled what was left on the walls. The stains also marked drapes, bedclothes, a sofa. Last had acted as capriciously as usual. A Stakhanovite poster clung garish, and 2 framed photographs were likewise unfallen. A young couple at their wedding, a white-bearded Uncle Vanya, who might be the grandfather of bride or groom. 3 or 4 others had crashed. Some strewn books and magazines moldered. A small radio lay among them. A clock had gone silent on its table. Flowers in pots were brown stalks. Apart from utensils and the like, Katya didn't notice more personal possessions. Maybe they had been meager enough for the family to take along an evacuation. She had no wish to investigate, when she might turn up a little girl's doll or a little boy's bear. She could merely hope the owners had escaped, all of them. She went through the rooms. People had slept in both. The first faced approximately north, the second east. With the door open between them, she could scan a full half-circle, springing from window to window. That vision covered a dozen streets in both directions, because most of the vicinity was a crumbled wasteland. Yet it had never occurred to the enemy either to occupy or to dynamite such a watchpost. Well, everybody got stupid now and then, especially in war. This time, Soviet intelligence had spied a Nazi blindness. Returning to the room of entry, she found the infantryman hunched on the sofa. He had taken off his helmet and outer coat. The sweat in his shirt was rank. Well, Katya thought, I'm scarcely a rose garden myself. When did I last have a proper bath? Ages ago, that night in the forest when I went to earth in a peasant's hut. His hair was curly. A hint of color had risen in his face. "Beware taking a chill, comrade," she warned. "We'll be here a while." She set her rifle down and unshipped her canteen. "You must need water worse yet than I do. So you go first, but don't take much. Swish it around in your mouth before you swallow. It has to last us." While he did, she squatted, took his injured hand in both hers, shook her head, and clicked her tongue. "Nasty," she said. "Those bones are a mess. At least no major blood vessel was cut. I can do something for it. Hold still, this will hurt." He caught his breath repeatedly when she cleaned and wrapped the wounds. Thereafter, she gave him a piece of chocolate. "We'll share my rations, too," she promised. "They're scant, but hunger is a joy set beside our real problems, no?" The bite revived him somewhat. He managed a shaky smile. "What is your name in heaven, you angel?" he quavered. She checked both the windows. Nothing except the distant cannon fire. "Me, an angel?" she replied, meanwhile, with a grin. "What kind of communist are you?" "I'm not a party member," he said humbly. "I should have joined. My father wanted me to, but, well, after the war." She put a chair in front of him and settled down. There was no sense in constantly staring out. She'd hear any important movement, as quiet as things were. A glance every few minutes would serve. "What are you, then?" she asked. "Pyotr Sergeyevich Kulyakov, private, 62nd Army." A tingle passed through her spine. She whistled softly. "Kulyakov! What a perfectly splendid omen!" "Eh? Oh, yes. Kulyakovo, where Dmitri Donskoy smote the Mongols." He sighed. "But that was 600 years ago, almost." "True. I remember how we rejoiced when the news reached our village. And we aren't supposed to believe in omens any longer, are we?" She leaned forward, interested. "So you know the exact date of that battle, do you?" "Even now, exhausted, in pain, penned up to wait for possible death. You sound educated." "My family in Moscow is. I hope someday to become a professor of classics." He tried to straighten. His voice took on a ghost of resonance. "But who and what are you, my rescuer?" "Ekaterina Borisovna Tazurina, the latest of my names, my self-created identities." "A woman soldier. We exist, you know." She mastered her annoyance. "I was a partisan before the fighting swept me here. Then they put me in uniform. Not that that's likely to make any difference if the Germans catch me. And when I'd passed Lieutenant Zaitsev's course, they raised me to sergeant because a sharpshooter needs some freedom of action." Pyotr's eyes widened. They had heard about Zaitsev from end to end of the Soviet Union. "This must be a special mission for you, not just sniping." Katya nodded. "Word came from Pavlov's house. Do you know what I mean?" "Of course. A building hereabouts, right in among the Germans, that Sergeant Pavlov and a few heroes have held since the end of September, hasn't it been?" She forgave him repeating the obvious. He was hurt, bewildered, and oh, how young. "They maintain communication with us," she explained. "Certain things they've noticed give reason to believe the enemy plans a major thrust into our end of town. No, I wasn't told what things. No need for me to hear. But I was sent to watch from this point and report whatever I see." "And you happened to pass by when—" "Incredible luck for me." Tears welled. but my poor friends. What happened? Our squad went on patrol. My unit's currently in a block of detached houses well south of Mamaev. We didn't expect trouble, as quiet as it's gotten. Pyotr drew an uneven breath, but all at once it was shooting and screaming and... My comrades dropped, right and left. I think I was the last one alive after a few minutes. And with this hand, what could I do but run? How many Germans? Where did they come from? How were they equipped? I couldn't tell. Everything went too fast. He sank his face into his left palm and shuddered. Too terrible. She gnawed her lip, angry. If you're with the 62nd, you've had months of combat experience. The enemy drove you back from Ostrov, was it? All the way across the plain to here, and still you couldn't pay attention to what was going on around you. He braced himself. I can try to remember. That's better. Take your time. Unless something dislodges us first, we'll be sitting where we are till we've seen what headquarters ought to know about, whatever that may be. She checked the windows, came back, sat down again before him, took his good hand. Now that he was out of immediate danger, nature wanted him to sleep and sleep and sleep, but that couldn't be allowed. What he had suffered wasn't overpoweringly severe. He was young and healthy, and when she spoke soothingly, she saw how her femaleness helped rouse him. Fragment by fragment, a half-coherent story emerged. It appeared the Germans had been reconnoitering. Their force was small, but superior to the Russian squad. Knowing themselves to be in hostile territory, they had kept totally alert and seen an opportunity to ambush Pyotr's group. Yes, clearly they wanted prisoners to take back. Katya knew a grim hope that he was, in fact, the single survivor. A scouting mission was a strong indication of a major attack in the works. She wondered if she ought to consider that this information fulfilled her task and returned with it at once. Of course, when the squad failed to report, the officer who dispatched it would guess the truth, but that might not be for a considerable time. No, probably the story wasn't worth as much as the possibility of her gaining more important knowledge here. Then Pyotr? If he didn't make it, the Red Army wouldn't have lost much, unless he blundered into captivity. Could he hold out a while under torture, or would his broken body betray him into betraying her? It wasn't a chance she wanted to take, nor was it fair to him. Helping him summon forth what his whole being cried out to forget, that wrought a curious intimacy. In the end, while they shared water and bread, he asked shyly, "Are you from hereabouts, Katya Borisovna?" "No, far to the southwest," she answered. "I thought so. You speak excellent Russian, but the accent, though it isn't quite Little Russian either, I think." "You've a sharp ear." Impulse seized her. Why not? It was no secret. "I'm a Kazakh." He started. Water spluttered from his lips. He wiped them, a clumsy, shaken gesture, and said, "A Cossack? But you? You're well educated yourself, I can hear that," and she laughed. "Come now, we're not a race of horse barbarians. I know. Our schooling is actually better than average, or used to be." The ray of mirth vanished behind winter clouds. "Before the revolution, most of us were farmers, fishers, merchants, traders who went far into Siberia. We did have our special institutions, yes, our special ways. Lo, our kind of freedom. That was why I drifted toward them after I ceased teaching embroidery at the cloister school in Kiev. That is why I have been with them, and of them, almost from their beginnings, these 400 years, a scrambling together of folk from Europe and Asia, down along the great rivers and over the unbounded steppes of the south, armed against Tatar and Turk, presently carrying war to those ancient foes. But mainly we were smallholders. We were a free people. Yes, women also, not as free as men, but vastly more than they had come to be everywhere else. I was always a person in my own right, possessed of my own rights, and it was never very hard to start a new life in another tribe when I had been too long in one. I know, but forgive me," Pyotr blurted. Here you are, a Soviet soldier, a patriot. I heard that, well, that Cossacks have gone over to the fascists wholesale. Some did, Katya admitted starkly. Not most. Believe me, not most. Not after what we saw. At first we had no knowledge. The commissars told us to flee. We stayed fast. They pleaded with us. They told us what horror Hitler wreaks wherever his hordes go. Your newest lie, we jeered. Then the German tanks rolled over our horizon, and we learned that for once the commissars had spoken truth. It didn't happen only to us, either. The war threw me together with people from the whole Soviet Ukraine, not Cossacks, ordinary little Russians, little people driven to such despair that they fight side by side with the communists. Even so, yes, true, thousands and thousands of men have joined the Germans as workers or soldiers. They see them as liberators. After all, she went on hastily, it's in our tradition to resist invaders and rise against tyrants. The Lithuanians were far away. They mostly left us alone and were content with the name of overlords. But the Polish kings goaded us into revolt over and over. Mazeppa welcomed the great Russians in and was made a prince of the Ukraine. But soon he found himself in league with the Swedes, hoping they might set us free. We finally made our peace with the Tsars. Their yoke was not unbearably heavy anymore. But later the Bolsheviks took power. Pyotr frowned. I've read about those Cossack rebellions. Katya winced. 3 centuries fell from her, and she stood again in her village when men, neighbors, friends, 2 sons of hers, galloped in after riding with Khmelnytsky and shouted their boasts. Every Catholic or Uniat priest they or the serfs caught, they hanged in front of his altar alongside a pig and a Jew. Barbaric times, she said. The Germans have no such excuse. And the traitors have less yet. Traitors? Vasily, the gentle blacksmith. Stefan, the laughterful. Fyodor, the fair, who was a grandson of hers and didn't know it. How many millions of dead there, they seeking to avenge? The forgotten ones, the obliterated ones. But she remembered. She could still see starvation shrivel the flesh and dim the eyes. Children of hers had died in her arms. Stalin's creatures shot her man, Mikhail, whom she loved as much as the ageless can love any mortal, shot him down like a dog when he tried to take for his family some of the grain they were shipping out in cram-full freight trains. He was lucky, though. He didn't go on another kind of train, off to Siberia. She had met a few, who came back. They had no teeth, and spoke very little, and worked like machines. And always you went in fear. Katya could not hold herself in. She must cry. They had their reasons. Pyotr gaped at her. What? He fumbled through his mind. Well, yes, kulaks. Free farmers, whose land that they had from their fathers was torn from them, and they herded into kolkhozes, like slaves. Promptly. That was how they felt, you understand. I don't mean the honest peasants, he said. I mean the kulaks, the rich landowners. I never met any, and I traveled rather widely. Some were prosperous, yes, because they farmed wisely and worked hard. Well, I don't want to offend you, Katya. You of all people. But you can't have traveled as much as you think. It was before your time, anyway. Pyotr shook his head. No doubt many of them meant well, but the old capitalist regime had blinded them. They resisted. They defied the law. Until they were starved to death. Ah, yes, the famine. A tragic accident. He ventured a smile. We're not supposed to call it an act of God. I said, no matter. I said they were starved to death. The harvests never failed. The state simply took everything from us. That brought us at last to submission. I only wanted to say that many Ukrainians feel they have a grievance. They never quite gave up hope. In their hearts, they resist yet. Indignation flashed. They are stupid. Katya sighed. They certainly made a bad mistake, those who went over to the Nazis. God help me, I might have myself. If Hitler had been willing, no. If he had been able to treat us as human beings, he would have had us all. This day he would hold Moscow, Leningrad, Novosibirsk. Stalin would cower among his gulags in the farthest corner of Siberia, or be a refugee with the Americans. But no, the fascists burned, raped, slew, tortured. They dashed out the brains of babies and laughed while they machine-gunned children, women, the old, the unarmed. They bayoneted for sport. They wrecked prisoners apart or doused them with gasoline and set them alight. Oh, it sickens me to think of them in holy Kiev. You knew what was right and did it, Pyotr said softly. You are braver than I. She wondered if fear of the NKVD had kept him from deserting. She had seen the corpses the green hats left along the roads by the thousands for a warning. "What made you join the partisans?" he asked. "The Germans occupied our village. They tried to recruit men from among us and kill those who refused. My husband refused." "Gotcha, gotcha." "Luckily, we were newly married and had no children. I was rather newly arrived there, bearing a fresh name. That has grown difficult under the communists. I have to search out slovenly officials. But they are common enough." Poor Ilya. He was so glad, so proud of his bride. We could have been happy together for as long as nature allowed. "Luckily," Pyotr knuckled fresh tears. "Regardless, you were very brave. I am used to looking after myself." "As young as you are?" he marveled. She couldn't help smiling. "I am older than I look," rising. "Time for another survey." "Why don't we each take a window?" he suggested. "We could watch almost without a break. I feel much better." "Thanks to you," he ended adoringly. "Well, we could..." Thunder rumbled. "Hold, artillery. Stay where you are." She sped to the north room. Early winter dusk was falling, the wreckage gone vague among shadows, but Mamayev still bulked clear against the sky. Fire flickered there. The crashing waxed widely about. "Our half-truce is over," she muttered when she came back to look east. "The big guns are busy." He stood at the middle of the floor, his features hard to see in the quickly thickening murk, but his voice uncertain. "Did the enemy begin it?" Katya nodded. "I think so. The start of whatever they have planned. Now we earn our pay, I hope." "Really?" The question trembled. "If we can get some idea of what is going on, how I wish we had a moon tonight." She chuckled dryly. "But I wouldn't expect the Germans to pick their weather to oblige us." "Keep quiet." She shuttled between windows. Dark deepened. Thin snow on untrafficked streets was slightly helpful to eyes and night glasses. The cannonade mounted. Abruptly, breath hissed between her teeth. She risked leaning out for a better view. Cold fell around her like a cloak. "What is it?" Pyotr tried to whisper. "Hush, I told you." She strained to be sure. Black blots on the next street over from this, headed straight north. A hunter could interpret traces for a soldier. Those were perhaps 100 men afoot, therefore infantry, but they dragged several carts on which rested faintly sheening shapes that must be mortars. They passed. She lowered her glasses and groped through the apartment till she found Pyotr. He had sat down, maybe in his weariness he had fallen asleep, but he sprang to his feet when she touched him. Tautness keened within her. "Germans bound for Krutoy Gully," she said into his ear. "Got to be on that route. If they wanted to go fight near the hill, they'd be headed westerly, and I might never have seen them. What do they intend?" "I don't know, but I can guess. It's surely part of a general offensive against our sector. The cannon, and maybe armor, attacking from the side. Those should hold our people's attention. Meanwhile, yonder detachment establishes itself in the ravine. It has the makings of a strong point. Our headquarters was in Tsaritsa Gorge, farther south, till the Germans took it at heavy cost. If they take and hold the Krutoy, why, troops can scramble straight through it, or their engineers might throw a new bridge across." "Do you mean we could lose the whole city?" "Oh, that alone won't do it." "We have our orders directly from Stalin. Here, at this place, he renamed in his own honor, here we stand. We die if need be, but the enemy shall not pass 1 centimeter beyond us. Every little thing counts, though. It would surely cost us hundreds of lives. This is what I came for. Now I go back and tell. She felt him shiver. We go. A dead man's hand clenched around her throat. She swallowed twice before she could say, not together. It's too important. This whole district will be a swarm. I'll have all I can do to get through alive, and I'm experienced. You must try by yourself. Wait here till tomorrow night, till it looks safer. Between her hands he straightened. No, my comrades are fighting. I ran away once, not again. What use will you be with that wound of yours? I can carry ammunition. Or, Katya, you might not make it. I might, by sheer luck, and let them know. He laughed or sobbed. A tiny, tiny chance, but who can say for certain? Oh, God, you idiot. Every little thing counts, you said. Yes, each scrap thrown into the furnace, it does become part of the steel. I mustn't delay, Pyotr. Give me, well, half an hour till you start, so I can get clear. Count to, I know some old songs and about how long they take. I'll sing them in my head while I think of you, Katya. Here. She undid objects and tossed them on the sofa. Food, water. You'll need strength. No, I insist. I'm not injured. God keep you, lad. You Russian. We'll meet again, won't we? Say we will. Instead, she cast her arms about him and laid her mouth on his. Just for a minute. Just for a memory. She stepped back. He stood. His breath went like flaws of wind in the dark. Springtime wind? Amidst the hammering of the guns. Do be careful, she said. Taking up her rifle, she felt her way to the door, and down the stairs, and into the streets. Tanks roared somewhere on her left. Would the Germans mount a night attack? Likely or faint. But she was no strategist, merely a sharpshooter. Flashes etched skeletal buildings against a reddened sky. She felt the racket through her boot soles. Hers was simply to deliver a message. Or to survive. What had she to do with the cruel follies of mortals? Why was she here? Well, you see, Pyotr, dear, I am a Russian, too. A park, a piece of openness between these jagged walls, glimmered white before her. A solitary tree was left. The rest were stumps and splinters around a crater. She skirted it, keeping to shadows. Likewise would she skirt the ravine, and be most cautious when she came to the railroad tracks that led to the Lazur. She must arrive with her word. She doubted Pyotr would. Well, if not, he'd stop a bullet or two that might otherwise have gone into somebody more effective. If somehow he kept alive, Maria of the Mercies let him. Help him. Of course they'd never see each other, or hear, or anything. Suppose two grains of dust are whirled together for a moment when a storm runs over the steppe. Will it bring them back? Certainly never her to him. She would be changing identities again before long. Whenever the four horsemen rode across the world, they opened easy ways for doing that. She could not have stayed much more with the Cossacks anyhow. But first, the guns boomed louder. Given the news she bore, the Soviet artillery would take aim at Krotoy Gully. It would blast the Germans out of there before they could dig in. That would be that, while the war went on. Work, you guns! Bring down the wrath of Dash Bog and Perun, of St. Yuri the Dragon Slayer and St. Alexander Nevsky. Here we stand. The thing that bestrides all Europe shall come no farther than us. If we fight in the name of a monster, that makes no difference, and we don't really. Once this Stalingrad was Tsaritsyn, it can become something else some day in the future. But good for now to think that we hold fast in the City of Steel. We will endure and prevail and abide the day of our freedom. Chapter 18. Judgment Day. 1. At first it was as if half a century had never been. Snow peaks gleamed against unutterable blue. In this clarity, they seemed almost near enough to touch, though any of them might be 50 miles remote. A road that was little more than a track rose, fell, writhed through a darkness of deodars and gnarly wild fruit trees, where langurs scampered. Then the forest opened onto pastures strewn with boulders, intensely green after the rains. Sheep and cattle grazed among stone threshing floors. Tiny terraces carved from the valley walls bore maize, amaranth, buckwheat, barley, potatoes. A westering sun breathed a ghost of purple across the heights that looked into it, while across from them shadows lengthened, intricate over the wrinkles of the land. The air smelled of grass and glaciers. As his mule brought him nearer the village, Wanderer began to see how much it had in fact changed. It had grown. Most of the new houses were not earth-roofed stone, but timber, 2 or 3 stories high, with carved and painted galleries. It was curious to find something so like Swiss chalets here on the knees of the Himalayas. Wires ran from a former dwelling which must house a generator, and the fuel tanks outside it also supplied a battered truck. A satellite receiver dish quite likely served more than a single communal television set. The folk were still Bhutias, essentially Tibetan stock, and men still generally wore the traditional long woolen coat, women the sleeved cloak. But he spied occasional sneakers or blue jeans, and he wondered how many people held by the mingled Buddhism, Hinduism, and animism that had been the faith of their fathers. Herders and workers in the fields swarmed to meet him, soon joined by those who had been at home. Excitement capered and shouted. Any visit from outside was an event, and this newcomer was extraordinary. His 2 attendants were simply Gurkhas, familiar enough, guides to manage the animals and serve his needs, but he himself rode altogether strange. Clad like a white man, but broad of face and bronze of skin, his nose jutting, yet his hair and eyes and cheekbones akin to theirs. One woman, shriveled and toothless with age, made an abrupt sign against evil, and scuttled from the crowd into a house. One man, equally old, drew a sharp breath before he bowed very low. They remembered his earlier call on them, Wanderer knew, when they were children, and he just the same as today. His senior Gurkha spoke with another woman, large and strong, who must be something like the mayor. She in turn addressed the villagers. A sort of calm descended. They eddied around the party, silent or talking in undertones, while it made its way through the lanes to a house at the northern edge of settlement. This seemed much as it had been. It remained the biggest, of stone and wood, an alien grace to its lines. Glass shone in the windows. Graveled paths twisted about the shrubs, dwarf trees, bamboo, and stones of a small, exquisite garden at the rear. The servants who emerged were of a new generation, but the man and woman who trod onto the veranda and waited were not. Wanderer dismounted. Slowly, under awed stares and a hush, he walked to the steps and up. He bowed before the two, and they returned the gesture with equal gravity. "Welcome," said the man, and, "Oh, boundlessly welcome," the woman. He was Chinese, powerfully built, rather flat of countenance and without guile in it. She was Japanese, well-formed in a petite fashion, cat-alert beneath the schooled serenity. Both wore robes, simple, though of the best material. They had used Nepali, of which Wanderer had but a few words. "Thank you," he replied in Mandarin Chinese. "I have returned as I promised." He smiled. "This time I took the trouble to learn a language you understand." 50 years, the woman breathed, using that tongue. "We could not be sure. We could only wait and wonder." At last," the man said as shakily. He raised his voice in the tribal dialect. "I told them we will hold a feast of rejoicing tomorrow," he explained. "Our servants will see to your men. Please come inside where we can be alone and honor you rightfully, sir, John Wanderer," the American supplied. "Why, that is what you called yourself before," the woman said. Wanderer shrugged. What difference, after so long and in a foreign country? I like the name, take it again and again, and otherwise usually a version of it. Who are you being? What does that matter any more? It came as a bass cry from the man's throat. We are what we are, together for always. The room where they conferred was gracious, the furniture Chinese, a variety of objects on shelves. The pair had adventured widely before they raised up this home. That was in 1810, as nearly as Wanderer could figure from the calendar they employed. Subsequently, they had absented themselves from time to time for years on end, gone to oversee the businesses that kept them prosperous, brought souvenirs back. Those included books. Duchon found his diversion mainly in handicrafts, but Asagao was quite a reader. In the presence of their fellow immortal, they chose to recall those ancient names. It was as if they snatched for a handhold, now when once more their world was falling to pieces. Nevertheless, joy overrode uneasiness. "We hoped so. Hoped you really were what you seemed to be," Asagao said. "How we hoped! More than an end to loneliness. Others like us, why, that gives meaning to these lives of ours, does it not?" "I can't say," Wanderer replied. "Besides you, my friend and I know of only one who is certainly alive, and he refuses to associate himself with us. We may be mere freaks." From the end table next his chair, he lifted a cup and took a sip of the pungent local chong, followed by a mouthful of tea. They comforted. "Surely we are on earth for a reason, however mysterious," Asagao insisted. "At least Duchon and I have tried to serve some purpose beyond surviving." "How did you find us 50 years ago?" the man asked in his pragmatic way. No real conversation had been possible then, when everything passed through an interpreter who had better not realize what meaning lay behind the words he rendered. Wanderer could just hint. Presently he thought these two had caught his intent and were doing likewise. They made it clear that they had no wish to depart, nor did they invite him to prolong his stay. Yet they were abundantly courteous, and when he risked his guide's astonishment and suggested that he return in 50 years, their answer throbbed with eagerness. Today they all knew, past any doubt, what they were. "I was always restless, never fond of cities, for I began as a wild plainsman," Wanderer related. "After the First World War, I set off around the world. My friend Hanno, he uses different identities, but between us he is Hanno. He had grown rich in America, and gave me ample money, hoping I might come on the track of somebody like us. Nepal was not easy to reach or enter in those days, but I guessed that on that account it could harbor such persons. In Kathmandu I caught rumors of a couple in the uplands who lived a kind of baronial existence among tribespeople whose benefactors and teachers they were. In spite of treating themselves well, they were considered holy. The story went that when they grew old they left on pilgrimage, and their son and his wife reappeared in their place. Imagine how such a tale drew me." Asagao laughed. "Things were never so simple, of course," she said. "Our people aren't fools. They keep up the fiction about us because that is plainly what we want, but they know quite well that the same two come back to them. They don't fear or envy us. Their nature is to accept various lots in life. To them, yes, we are sacred and full of power, but we are also their friends. We sought long and far to find ourselves a home like this." "Besides," Duchon grunted, "they don't care to be overrun by worshippers, curiosity-seekers, and the government and its tax-collectors. At that, we have to deal with several visitors a year, more than that lately. Stories do get about. Only our distance from everything keeps them faint enough to protect us." Wanderer nodded. "I would probably have ignored them if I hadn't been on the lookout, but nevertheless the modern world seems to be moving in." "We cannot forbear to bring what is good," Asagao murmured. "Literacy, medicine, awareness, whatever lightens these hard lives without corrupting them too much." Wanderer bleakened. "It would have happened anyway, wouldn't it? You are losing control, aren't you?"
"I said we get more strangers all the time,"
Dushan snapped. "And inspectors from the king. Such hardly ever sought us out before, nor did they ask as many questions. We know the country is changing. The whole world is in upheaval," Asagao sighed. "Dear has this place been to us, but we understand that we must eventually disappear from it forever."
"Or else become known for what you are,"
Wanderer agreed low.
"Do you wish that? If so, tell me. I leave tomorrow, and in America change my name."
He left unspoken that he had not uttered any modern name of Hanno's.
"We have thought of it," Dushan admitted. "Sometimes in the past we made no pretense."
He paused. "But that was always among simple country folk, and we could always withdraw and hide again when danger threatened. I am not sure we can do that any longer."
"You cannot, once you are found out. They will track you down if you try, for they have many means these days to hunt men. Afterward, you will be slaves, no doubt well housed and well fed, but never set free. Animals for them to study."
"Is it really that bad?" "I fear it is," Asagao said. "To Wanderer, we have spoken much about it, Dushan and I. The king of Nepal might treat us kindly as his pet animals. But what if the Red Chinese or the Russians demand our persons?"
"At least keep your freedom," Wanderer urged. "You can proclaim yourselves when the times look auspicious to you, but I do not think they are yet, and once you have done so, there will be no more choices."
"Do you mean for us to go away with you?"
"I hope you will,
or at any rate, follow me soon. Hanno will provide for you. Whatever you need that is in his power to get, and his power is great."
End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.